Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
An historic decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, which has struck down the ban on physician-assisted suicide. The top court has placed restrictions on the practice and given the government a year to come up with legislation. We speak with Conservative MP Stephen Fletcher about where we go from here.
This ruling will have a major impact on the medical profession, which has already been dealing with an ethical divide on the matter. To find out what doctors will be doing to prepare for this change, we speak with the president of the Canadian Medical Association.
The RCMP makes an arrest and lays terrorism charges against three Ottawa men who have allegedly been involved in an ISIS recruiting ring, but it comes as questions are raised about the government's new anti-terror legislation. We speak with a former privacy commissioner and a former spy watchdog about the concerns.
And the McLean's panel discusses John Baird's surprise resignation, as well as the NDP's $2.7 million bill over their satellite offices.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. A landmark ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada as our country's top judges strike down the complete ban on physician-assisted death. The decision was unanimous from all nine justices that the current ban infringes on the rights of liberty and security of persons. But the court has placed several conditions on who would be allowed to go through with this process. It has to be a competent adult who gives clear consent to end their life, and the patient must be suffering from intolerable pain from a grievous medical condition. That means it's not limited to someone with a terminal illness.
This is a big victory for those who fought this court challenge since 2010. Lee Carter is one of the plaintiffs in the case. She helped bring her mother, who was suffering from ALS, to Switzerland so she could have a medically assisted suicide. Carter got emotional while speaking to the media after the ruling.
As a woman who always enjoyed a spirited debate, around the dinner table, Kay would smile at this outcome and the conversation it has initiated about death and end-of-life options. Justice, dignity, and compassion were defining qualities of my mother. This ruling now extends those same elements to individuals seeking a humane and dignified death in this country. A huge victory for Canadians and a legacy for Kay. Thank you, Mama. Thank you.
Many other groups were outraged by this decision. Those opposed to the move, such as the Institute for Canadian Values, say unelected appointed judges are acting as philosopher kings ruling over the country. So where do we go from here? The courts have given the federal and provincial governments a year to come up with legislation to respond. But if nothing happens and the deadline passes, the court ruling would stand without additional regulations. Justice Minister Peter MacKay isn't indicating what he'll do.
There's a broad range of thoughts and views on this by Canadians. The decision has just come down, so we're going to view it thoroughly.
But one Conservative MP is, like the opposition, hoping for quick action. Stephen Fletcher already has a private member's bill in Parliament that lays out a regulatory framework for physician-assisted death. Fletcher became a quadriplegic in 1996 after a car accident and has admitted at one point in his life he wanted the option to die. I was able to speak with him at the Supreme Court following the ruling.
First of all, how are you feeling after this historic decision?
I'm feeling elated, relieved, and pleased for the Canadian people, and I think people who will find themselves in difficult situations will have a sense of peace of mind because they know that they have one more option that they didn't have an hour ago.
Now, the Supreme Court hasn't limited this to terminal illness. It's left it more broad in that regard, but it's also placed several restrictions on this. What do you think of those restrictions?
Well, what the Supreme Court has done actually, almost word for word, has used, or it seems like my private member's bill, like the guts of it, and what the Supreme Court has said are almost identical. And I'm I'm okay with it. Like the restrictions, I haven't read the whole ruling, but I assume it's, you know, you have to be a competent adult over 18, and that's very reasonable. I think that's fine.
You said beforehand that you were hoping that your private member's bill would act as a framework moving forward if the decision came out as to what it is right now.
Yeah.
Do you think you have the support from your colleagues on the government side to use your private member's bill as a framework?
I believe that, first of all, the government will obey the law, they will take direction from the Supreme Court. My PMB is structured and would meet the criteria that the Supreme Court has set out. But there's lots of ways to skin a cat. What I like to do is have a bill, my bill or another bill, go before a parliamentary committee to get it think bills should go through the grinder, my bill hasn't done that yet.
Do you think that the government will deal with this before the next election? It's a very controversial issue that definitely creates a divide amongst Canadians. So are you hopeful that it will actually be dealt with before the next election?
I'm not sure. I don't think there is a divide amongst Canadians. 85% of Canadians support physician-assisted death. I can't think of another issue where there's that kind of unanimity or that kind of support amongst Canadians. And if it's going to be, if the government deals with it before the writ is dropped, it'll be dealt with. If it doesn't, then it's going to be an election issue.
Do you think they want this as an election issue, though? I because you do sit on the government side of the house.
My preference is to deal with it as soon as possible.
Mr. Fletcher, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you for your time.
That was Conservative MP Stephen Fletcher.
While this decision does not compel doctors to participate in physician-assisted suicide, there are big implications for Canada's medical profession. For more of a perspective from doctors on this landmark decision, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes talked with Dr. Chris Simpson, president of the Canadian Medical Association.
You can't have been completely surprised by the decision this morning. Was it something that you and the CMA were braced for?
Very much so. I think you're right that I was not surprised. We were not surprised. Perhaps the unanimous decision was a little bit of a surprise. But at the CMA, we've been preparing for this eventuality for the last year and a half or 2 years.
Hmm. And would you say that physicians in Canada, is there a way to? I'm sure there's a wide diversity of opinion, but do you think there will be a lot of physicians who are unsettled by this? Are most sort of resigned to the idea that they're going to have to think about these things? How would you describe the mood in your membership?
Well, we went through a very careful process, as you may recall, in partnership with Maclean's. We did some town halls last year,
yes,
and went across the country and heard from Canadians and heard from other doctors as well. And that really critically informed, I think, the process of change in the profession and in our organization. Because at the end of the day, of course, there was no consensus achieved, but the really powerful stories on both sides of the debate, I think, really had everybody step back and reflect and say, there can't be a one-size-fits-all. We have to have the ability to fit everybody's legitimate concerns and aspirations here. So we did actually pass a policy at our last general council that said that we would support our members, doctors, and their patients who chose to pursue medical aid in dying should the legal environment change. And today, of course, it did.
Can you say something about what the court said about the ability of doctors who have religious or just personal conscience reasons for not wanting to help patients and their lives? So were you satisfied with the wording in the decision on that score?
I think so. We're very clear that, and I think it's fair to say that no patient would want a physician to be individually coerced into doing something that they felt was against their personal morals or ethics or religious beliefs. That's not going to serve anybody well. And there was nothing in the language in the ruling today that suggested that individual physicians would be compelled. So I think over the next 12 months, which is the time frame everybody has to think about this and get something robust in place, we'll need to balance the need now to provide this service in an equitable way to the small number of patients who need it and are eligible for it, and protecting individual physicians from being coerced if they, as individuals, feel that they don't want to participate in this.
Doctor, I was lucky to have been involved in one of those town halls you referred to that we did last year. I was in the one up in Whitehorse, and I was struck there by the degree to which it seemed like there's a huge overlap between people's concerns about a doctor-assisted dying and their concerns about just palliative care and good end-of-life care, where a lot of people, it seemed to me, were having trouble disentangling the two. Like, you know, they thinking that, well, if only there was a really good, well-funded, well-thought-out system for palliative care and giving people the best chance they have of a decent end-of-life experience, that would alleviate a lot of the pressure for doctor-assisted suicide. Well, can you comment on that?
It's a very interesting and nuanced point, but I agree with you, it's really important, because we can't lose sight of the fact that no matter how this all shakes out in the end, it's very unlikely that the number of patients who are going to be eligible for and carry out medical aid in dying is very small. And yet, we only have 16% of Canadians who would benefit from it receiving good palliative care. So we can't lose sight of the bigger end-of-life envelope in all of this. We do need better palliative care.
Can I interrupt you just for a sec? Could you repeat that statistic? What percentage of Canadians need good palliative care are getting it now?
It's our estimate is that 16% of patients who would benefit from palliative care in Canada actually receive it out of the 250,000 people who die every year.
And on a practical level, what does that mean? What are they not getting?
Sometimes it's something just as simple as appropriate pain control or other symptoms like shortness of breath, for example, that can often characterize some diseases at end of life. What happens in a lot of places is that they're brought into hospital simply because that's the only place those medications are available, rather than being able to die at home as they want. We have pockets of great palliative care in Canada, and then other pockets where it's completely non-existent. But I think even if we had perfect palliative care in Canada, we know that there will be very rare cases where even the best palliative care is not good enough. And those are the patients, I think, for whom medical aid in dying may potentially be a solution for them.
A last question on what's going to happen over the next 12 months. In the past, when the Supreme Court has brought down not similar decisions, but sort of parallel decisions in the sense that they've given the government a year generally to work on it. I'm thinking about the prostitution decision, for example. It's really been something that's been just in the hands of federal lawmakers. This is not so straightforward. Do you think there needs to be some form of, you know, federal provincial physicians organization task force or group set up now to work on regulations? How do you think, on a practical level, the next 12 months should be spent in terms of coming up with an answer to the position the Supreme Court has now put everyone in?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we'll be seeking, is some mechanism for us to have a prominent role in the crafting of the new rules and regulations and legislation. And I would expect that other stakeholders at the table would include both of the senior levels of government and the regulatory bodies, as well as patient groups. Everybody needs to be comfortable that the details are, true to the Supreme Court's intent, and also something that the Canadians can be comfortable with on both sides of the debate.
That was Dr. Chris Simpson, president of the Canadian Medical Association, speaking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
Coming up on the show, we speak with a former privacy commissioner and a former head of Canada's spy watchdog about the government's new anti-terror legislation, and the Maclean's panel discusses the abrupt departure of John Baird. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel discusses the surprise resignation of John Baird and the NDP's $2.7 million bill from the Board of Internal Economy over their satellite offices. But first...
This week, the RCMP arrested one person and charged two others with terrorism-related offenses. It's alleged the three Ottawa men, all in their 20s, were part of a recruiting network for ISIS. The terrorism charges came only days after the government tabled controversial new anti-terrorism legislation.
Bill C-51 would expand the powers of CSIS, the federal spy agency, and also allow government departments to share more confidential information. For instance, tax forms or passport applications could be shared with police. And that raises concerns about privacy. For insights into those worries, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with Chantal Bernier, the former privacy commissioner and now a privacy security specialist at the law firm Dentons. Bernier started out explaining why information sharing among branches of the federal government matters in the first place.
That sharing of information can lead to some further information, right? It produces its own information and can be inaccurate and invasive. So the triangulation that comes out of putting together information from one department and another is useful precisely, that's the reason they want it, is useful because it can bring authorities to draw conclusions. However, one must ask, number one, is this ability then to produce more information on the basis of information legitimate? And I'll go in a minute as to what the legitimate test is.
Okay.
And secondly, is it reliable? Because sometimes you put two and two together and you get to five.
So you're saying one organization has a bit of information, the other organization has a bit of information, they combine them two and maybe jump to a conclusion that isn't valid.
Precisely. So this has to be looked at through, as I said, the legitimacy test. So this is what parliamentarians need to look at. Number one, and this is valid for the whole bill and all of the privacy implications for the bill, they need, first of all, to ask, why are these measures necessary? They need to put the policymakers, elected and non-elected, officials and minister, to this test. Tell us, why is this needed? I mean, there has to be an empirical demonstration that any curtailment of civil liberties is necessary. That's the test of the Charter, is that you need to demonstrate that the measure is demonstrably, the Charter uses the word demonstrably, which is right, important, demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. So how does that translate? It means give us the evidence that we need these measures. Give us the evidence that they would be effective, at the very least, that you have a cogent case to presume that they would be effective. Three, assure us that they will be used in a manner strictly proportionate to that need. And finally, tell us why aren't there, or why aren't you resorting to less intrusive alternatives?
It's interesting. It's you can imagine how some ordinary Canadians, though, will be hearing about this. So if they read or hear that, for example, the Canadian Border Service Agency might share information that they've gathered on someone traveling outside Canada with the police and shrug their shoulders and say, you know, who cares if the border people are talking to the police about who they know has crossed the border? You know what I mean? I think there might be a tendency for people to think this is information agencies of the government have anyway. The fact that they're distributing it more freely it doesn't seem like a new invasion of privacy. It's just, you know, the information they have on us already being distributed more widely.
Mm-hmm. And then I would reply two things. The first one is that complacency is based on the presumption that it will only affect the guilty, the ones that really should be followed. We hope, but that can only be ensured with strict mechanisms in the law that start with a very narrow power to invade privacy. And the second thing I would say is bring to them the very spectacular examples that we have had recently of at least two Canadians that have made it public, that have been stopped at the border because there was a police record on them because they had attempted suicide years before. And so that was in the police record. They've done nothing wrong, it's rather heartbreaking, if anything.
Yes, yes.
And they find themselves stopped at the border because, indeed, they are somewhere on a police database.
Can I ask, are there oversight measures or reporting measures that might ease some of the very legitimate concerns you've expressed on this?
Mm-hmm. There are, and I've been thinking about this a lot, watching the debate that I'm very happy to see, because the special report to Parliament that I tabled on January 28, 2014 was meant precisely to generate a debate as to whether we had the oversight we needed for national security in this day and age. And the debate is occurring, and I think that is extremely healthy. The debate seems to polarize around two views. The first one, that more oversight would be mere duplication, that what we have now is more than sufficient. And the other view being, no, what we have now does not replace the very unique role that parliamentarians could play. And, of course, it is mentioned that our Five Eyes partners do have parliamentarians.
This is
committees.
New Zealand, Britain, U.S., Australia, right?
Precisely, yeah. Precisely.
They all have parliamentary oversight over this sort of thing.
Precisely. So what I would suggest is actually a solution in the middle, and an easy one, I might add, that would not duplicate with the very competent oversight bodies that we already have. Quite simply, parliamentarians exercise the power they already have to bring officials, elected and non-elected, to answer questions on behalf of Canadians. To, as we saw February 2014, where Michel Coulombe and the head of CSIS and the head of CSEC, John Foster, went to Parliament and actually a parliamentary committee and actually spent hours answering questions televised for all Canadians to see.
So regularize that, make that a standard thing rather than an exception.
Precisely, precisely.
I think a lot of Canadians, during a period when they've seen, events both close to home, in the October 22nd attack here in Ottawa, but then also things out in the world, the horrible attacks in Paris. I think a lot of people naturally, the pendulum of public opinion swings towards saying, well, we need sterner security measures. Do you think that it's possible to get people to think in some kind of balanced, dispassionate way about their rights in this sort of very heated environment that we're in right now?
It is possible if indeed we have an informed debate. So, for example, some commentators have said that Bill C-51 must be examined outside any form of partisanship. And I agree with that. Our only test is Canadian values and reality of need. That's why I said earlier on that is the test that the parliamentarians must apply. So if indeed we do have that dispassionate yet deep, well-informed debate, I think Canadians will be therefore empowered, will have the information to make up their own mind and see the balancing and assess whether indeed this is necessary at the time or not. Because it truly is predicated on the basis upon need, in demonstrable need, in a free and democratic society. And that's what we need to assess here.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes talking with Chantal Bernier, the former Federal Privacy Commissioner.
While the government seeks to increase the powers of CSIS, the opposition is pushing the government to increase the amount of oversight on the actions of our National Security Agency. One proposal would have a committee of parliamentarians charged with overseeing CSIS. After retiring from Parliament, where he served as an MP and cabinet minister, Chuck Strahl was appointed to the Security Intelligence Review Committee. CIRC is the arm's-length agency that reviews the actions of CSIS. Strahl served as chair of CIRC before he stepped aside last year amid controversy over his work on behalf of Ambridge. I spoke with him on the phone. So, Chuck, thanks for joining us. You were the chair of CIRC for about a year and a half, from 2012 to 2014, and then you stepped aside. First of all, in your experience working with CIRC, you know, how robust is it? How good is the oversight that it provides?
Well, of course, it doesn't really provide oversight. It provides a review function, which is a little bit different. Each country and each agency in the country, I suppose, has different types of oversight or review. The CIRC, set up under legislation, is a review committee. So I think it does the review function quite well. It serves two big functions. One is it reviews any action of CSIS. It is subject to review by the Intelligence Review Committee. And then it's also the complaints department, kind of like the equivalent of the RCMP Public Complaints Commission. If you have a complaint against CSIS, that's where it goes, is to CIRC. So it provides those two functions. And by and large, I think it does it pretty well. There's always room for improvement. When I was there, we made recommendations in the reports to Parliament about how things could be improved. But overall, it's done pretty well. It stood the test of time pretty well.
I'm glad you brought up this issue of oversight versus review, because that has sort of come up in the discussion, I think, in the past week. You know, what is the major distinction there? Like, what does oversight provide that review doesn't, and vice versa?
Well, again, there's two models. When this agency was put together as part of the creation of CSIS, and then a review function that went with it, the McDonald Commission made these recommendations on how it might work and so on. And where Parliament finally settled was that it would be better to have a permanent independent review committee rather than have a partisan oversight committee. Well, I don't know, there's pros and cons to both, but the beauty of the review system is that you have complete, in Canada's case, you have complete access to anything that CSIS does. Except for cabinet documents. You can't review cabinet documents, but everything else is, by legislation, you're allowed to have a look at. And secondly, you can review everything. So you kind of do it in a risk management system, if you will. You know, that's the way a company would look at it. As you say, I'm not there every day to look at everything. That's what management's supposed to do. But what we do is risk assessment. So we make sure that, you know, we review the protocols that go into, say, how you get a warrant from a judge, or you go through how CSIS does their work overseas, or, you know, and so on. And you do a different two or three or half a dozen, depending on the year, half a dozen different reviews across CSIS's activities every year. And as time goes on, you know, you can't do it all every year, but as time goes on, you're continuously reviewing the work that they do. Now, in an oversight model, like they might have down in the States, what you do is, in real time, you're in oversight. You're sitting there with CSIS saying, you know, what are you planning to do this week? And then in the CIA's case, they say, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And the oversight committee says, okay, that looks good or doesn't look good, depending on. And then they more or less rubber stamp it. You know, the downside of that, I mean, that's good to have that kind of oversight. The downside of it is that you end up, you almost co-opt the oversight committee, because once they've agreed with your activities, they can hardly come back later and say they should have never done it. So, you know, there's the two models basically around the world, and by and large, the review process that we have has worked pretty well overall. And there's been a couple of instances where, or a couple of examples where we think it can be beefed up, but by and large, it's worked not bad.
What are the ways specifically that you would beef it up? I think I've read in the past that, you know, you've made comments about sort of the mandate and being able to look beyond CSIS. You know, are there other things, like what kind of specifically, if we're going to improve CIRC, or if that's where the focus needs to be, you know, what would we do?
Yeah. Well, it's mainly because the legislation is very powerful. When I talk to our counterparts in other and the other five I countries, they envied our legislation. It's very powerful. You can get any information about anything you want. So, you know, nothing is secret from the committee, and the committee can delve into it. And because the committee is made up of members of all political parties, you know, it gives you some assurance, obviously, that things are being properly reviewed. That said, there's, you know, one of the identified weaknesses in the legislation is that it was built during the Cold War, if you will. And so the kind of the silos that everybody worked in were more obvious. So CSIS did its thing, RCMP does its thing, and so on. You know. But now it's hard to see that those silos work in isolation. It's just too interrelated and intricate. And that's why we've talked about the ability to have gateways into other federal agencies to allow us to continue, you know, to follow the path of an investigation outside the realm of CSIS alone. And the reason for that is, for example, if you know, foreign affairs might be involved in some aspect, a concern about a security issue, CSIS then might get involved. Back home, the RCMP might be investigating a homegrown terrorist in the same plot. Meanwhile, Transport Canada has banned them from flying and put a no-fly sticker on their dossier. That means that, you know, there's at least four agencies involved here, but the CERC is only allowed to review the actions of CSIS alone. This is just the way it's set up under legislation. So we need some way of having gateways into these other agencies so that when something crosses over, the Air India thing is frequently cited as an example where, you know, the RCMP might have all kinds of information on something, but and so might CSIS. But if they're not talking to one another, then the terrorist might get away with literally murder by being dropped as he transfers through the responsibilities from one agency to another.
That was former MP and head of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, Chuck Strahl. To hear more of Strahl's thoughts on parliamentary oversight, go to macleans.ca.
Coming up on the show, the Macleans panel weighs in on John Baird's sudden departure and the controversy over the NDP's $2.7 million bill from the BIOE over their satellite offices. Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill.
It's now time for the Macleans panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Macleans, and we are joined by the Macleans Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks for being here. This week, we were all surprised when Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird, now ex-Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird, announced that he would be resigning from Cabinet and soon would be resigning as MP for Ottawa West Nepean. Were there any indications at all? Looking back now, can you see any indications that he was not happy with where things were headed and wanted out of federal politics?
I think we've seen these reports that he had been thinking about this for months. I mean, I don't know if I don't think I can look back and say, oh, yes, I saw this coming. By the same token, you know, John and I were having this conversation this week. Cabinet ministers resign eventually; like they aren't there forever. He'd been in federal and provincial politics for 20 years. He probably was at a job that he may never get a better job in government than he had right then. To me, there's all sorts of theorizing. Oh, was he pushed? Did he jump? Why is he leaving? To me, at the risk of being naive, it sort of makes sense that a guy at 45 would say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to go do another job for a while. We tend to get very shocked. I remember when Jim Prentice quit, we were all very shocked that he would quit. And then we all kind of get over it in a few days. I think we have to kind of be a bit reasonable about this and say that eventually these guys are going to leave. They aren't going to stay until they're 70 being cabinet ministers.
What difficulty does it leave, John, for the government moving forward? Within a year,
Jim Flaherty left cabinet and then unfortunately later passed away. Yeah. But then John Baird as well left cabinet. Yeah. Two major figures from Ontario politics that were in the cabinet.
Well, one thing that it reminds us of, and I'm going to say this flat out, is the general weakness of the federal cabinet. This is not a particularly strong federal cabinet. I've covered several different regimes in Ottawa, and none of them have been perfect. You don't see a Camelot round table being assembled in the Langevin block here. But this cabinet has only a few pillars to it. You would say, for sure, Jason Kenney. Baird was one. Tony Comeau has survived. I don't think he's a star political performer on the public stage, but he seems to be trusted to do a job. There are a couple of others you could have a debate about, but there aren't a lot of heavyweights in that cabinet. And so one thing we are seeing here is we're being reminded, why was there? Aaron mentioned there seemed to be almost a disproportionate level of interest in Baird leaving. I mean, it's a big story no matter what, but boy, we really focused on that. Why did we? Well, one reason is it's thin. You know, if you look at the cabinet and think, who are the big names? It's thin. So a guy like Baird, a guy like Kenney, Prentice when he left, these guys really stand out because there's not a deep bench there. So that's part of the story. So the challenge for the Prime Minister going into this important election year is that he needs not just competent ministers, but ministers he can put out who are presentable and interesting to the public. So take, for example, Joe Oliver, his finance minister. Many people would say this veteran Bay Street investment banker is a good kind of guy to have as finance minister. Not many people would say he's a great communicator, you know? And you could go down the list and say there are other people like that as well. John Baird, James Moore, Jason Kenney, these were guys, I would argue Rona Ambrose now, who sort of revived herself as a minister. These are people who are sort of legitimate big league politicians, but there aren't a lot of them. So you lose Baird. The first problem is you look around, who's your next guy to promote? Who's someone else who's proven that they deserve to go up a notch? It's hard to think of someone.
And then within the Conservative Party as well, Aaron, I mean, the criticism has always been that a lot of people, cabinet ministers and regular backbench MPs, take their orders and their marching orders from the PMO and just stick to their talking points. Baird was one of those voices that never really did that. He sort of blazed his own trail and did his own thing for a lot of this. What does that mean for the Conservative caucus and the Conservative Party to lose a person like Baird?
I think John's right. I think it hurts. You know, it's funny. We get into these, every time there's a shuffle, every time there's a resignation, I think the interesting discussion to be had is what exactly does a cabinet minister do at this point? Like, are they driving policy? Are they driving communication? Are they major figures that seem to be doing something? You know, this government, conservatives are very keen to point to the prime minister and say, well, under the prime minister's leadership, we've done X. Under the prime minister's leadership, we've done Y. And that ends up leaving you going, well, what are all those other 40 ministers doing? I do think it is a loss. It is it is one more voice that they don't have. It's another chance to kind of wonder, oh, well, is this government starting to run out of steam? If they can find someone who will step up into cabinet and fill that role, they might be okay. But it's another drag on a government going into another election.
All right, now let's look at the opposition, the NDP. There was another big story this week, and the Board of Internal Economy ordering the New Democrats to pay back the $2.75 million that was spread out from the office budgets of 68 MPs on their side, and they all pitched in for these satellite offices. They're claiming right now that this is a kangaroo court, this is the pylon, and they're really not happy with how this has gone. John, is this a legitimate issue that we should really be focused on, or should we believe the NDP that this is all just political and a pylon from the Liberals and the Conservatives?
I don't know if I would use the word kangaroo court, because I'm not sure you can dignify the Board of Internal Economy with the word court. I mean, the Board of Internal Economy is not a court of any sort. It's a closed door. It's just a ridiculous institution. We have this incredibly secretive, arcane group doing this. Is the complaint about what the NDP did with their budget legitimate? It might be. It looks like to me like they were pretty creative with the way they funded those satellite offices. On the other hand, were there clear rules in place? Has there been fair adjudication of what other parties have done? We have no way of knowing that, because that is not a court kangaroo otherwise. It's a star chamber that we have no way of looking into. We don't know what evidence they've considered. It doesn't appear like they talked to the MPs who are actually directly involved in this case. I don't know. From the outside, I think the process is, to the degree that I'm sympathetic with the NDP on this, it's because the process seems terrible. And that is stipulating that they may have done something wrong. They very well may have done something wrong here. But boy, as an outsider, and I mean journalists, any voter who cares to pay attention to this issue, wants to try to sort it out, good luck to you, because that process is closed. It is a black box. And I just think it's ridiculous we still have that in the heart of the management of the House of Commons. We have this ridiculous institution.
So let's talk about the voters who are not as in tune with...
There are many who are very in tune with the Board of Education. Oh, yeah. You know, lots of our listeners will have the minutes and they'll be dealing with that.
Yeah. It's a huge budget issue.
But, I mean, the voters who don't pay that much attention to politics, what they saw on the television screens or heard on the radio this week were a lot of NDP MPs walking by, not answering questions about paying back the money, and then some lines just saying, well, no, it's all them, it's not us, we didn't do anything wrong. Is the public perception on this a negative for the NDP right now moving forward?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think there's, I have a certain amount of sympathy for them in that their complaint that, you know, these are the Conservatives and the Liberals passing judgment on them.
True.
It's true. I mean, you can't really get around that. But yeah, it does. It doesn't help to have that hanging over your head. And if you want to be the party poking the government and saying, you know, you're unethical, you're abusing public funds, it doesn't help if they can come back and go, well, what about the 2.75 million? To how much that's going to actually matter in the long run, I don't know. I think a lot of times the public sort of just looks at this and goes, oh, this is politicians being jerks and they're crooks and we can't trust them and it's all this noise and bickering. I think there is an opening here for someone or some party to say, we're going to have major reform of how resources are spent on the Hill in terms of mailouts, in terms of office budgets. You know, we're going to cut down on the amount of money that is spent for strictly partisan purposes. And that would go, you know, even as far as the way the government has used their advertising budgets. You know, so maybe that's where this goes from here. Otherwise, I think it's a bit of a thorn in the side of the NDP, but otherwise I suspect it just gets sort of lumped in with the way this parliament has been in its sort of not greatest moments.
Yeah, and there's a lot of apathy right now, and also it's a very inside baseball story.
Sure,
I mean, a lot of people just arguing over the definition of where you can actually have an office
and
or not.
You know, these kinds of issues that involve public money, where they start to you know, where people start to worry about them is when it seems like someone has pocketed that public money, right? That's where people really start to worry. In this case, although the NDP, as I say, may have been quite creative in the way they used their budget, they used it for, you know, running party offices. There's no doubt about that. Nobody pocketed it. Nobody ran off with funds. Or, you know, there wasn't any of that kind of stuff. And that's, so it's still quite a bit removed from the worst kind of money scandal where I think voters really do get concerned.
All right, we'll have to wait and see how this all plays out and in court as well with the NDP fighting this. So thank you very much, John Geddes, the Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, Aaron Wherry, Maclean's Associate Editor and Co-host, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.